Welcome back, Nod Pod. Thank you guys so much for joining me for another episode of Chasing Heroin. And if you are watching on Spotify, I cut the intros off of YouTube now, so you're only seeing this on Spotify because, I don't know, I guess the intros on YouTube don't do as well. I don't know, I'm trying to figure out the analytics over there. But if you're watching on Spotify, and we're in this goofy little like Christmas tree headband because we just had our staff party, which was actually really fun. And I love this kind of stuff, even if it's like dorky or whatever. I love like holiday fanfare. I think it's because I was using for so long that I didn't have it for so long that it's made me like extra grateful for it now. Like I would have given anything to be a lady with like a Christmas tree headband on at an office party, you know, for so long, or someone that like decorated the house. And so I think it just gets me like extra grateful, you know, when I'm able to do that kind of stuff now. So I hope you guys are having a good holiday season so far. If that's something that you celebrate, something that you're into. The feedback I got from last week's episode was stellar, amazing, unbelievable. It's like many of y'all's favorite episode ever. And I really appreciate the feedback. It also helps me help you. Help me help you. When I get feedback like that, it's so good to know like, okay, this is what they're into. And it's also interesting because like, obviously I try to look for like maybe celebrities sometimes, or, you know, someone that's written a book, or like a thought leader, or somebody in the personal development space that's also in recovery. And y'all love the addicts I meet at meetings, you know, or someone from the Nod Pod that listens and just bares their soul. And it's like the rawness that I think you guys enjoy the most, you know, which is like cool and good for me to know. And today's show is actually very similar. Someone I met at a meeting, my friend Sam, and I heard him lead for 10 minutes. It was a short share. And in that 10 minutes, it was enough for me to see. I was like, I've got to ask this guy to be on the show. And similar to Christina's story, I knew a little, but I didn't know a lot. And it was enlightening and a wild ride to like go through his story, completely different than mine or so many others. And actually, you know, I was thinking, and I said this to him too, I know that in 12-step, I think I said this to Christina too, there's this whole idea of like, we don't talk about, they call it like war stories, because we all know what it's like out there. Let's talk about the solution. And like, I think that's fair to some degree, but also people's experiences are unique. And if you're like, if you've gone through something like Christina went through, you would so think like, dude, you don't know what I've been through. You know, you don't know what happened to me in Hawaii, you know, like you don't know. And so of course you're clean. You didn't live my life. And so I think there's a lot of value in sharing some of the details. So, you know, Sam's story again, different, unique, and he's got 6 months clean and sober right now. He had 10 months and then drank and has 6 months now. And one of the wildest meth paranoia stories I've ever heard. I was not expecting this at all. The story is crazy. And I was like cracking laughing when he told me. It's another one. It's like Christina, I'm like, I can't believe this dude lived, you know, like I can't believe he made it through that. So I really think you guys are going to like today's episode as well. Oh, also, by the way, if you did listen to Christina's story and it really moved you, if you haven't yet, maybe shoot her a DM and say thank you. Because again, she's not like a speaker. She didn't write a book. She just showed up and left everything she had on the stage. And Sam does today as well. And I feel like that just demands so much respect when somebody is willing to say like, this is hard for me to talk about, but I think somebody else might help it. So like, here, go, you know, I value that. So yeah, if you haven't yet, maybe just say thanks. And I know you guys are going to feel that way about Sam's story tonight as well. Okay. So I haven't done a Nod Pod shout out of the week in like a while. So I wanted to do one. This is from Apple Podcasts, my fave, from November 14th, King's Daughter, 777. 5 stars. This is by far my favorite podcast. It helped me so much, especially when I first found recovery. Every episode has touched my heart in its own special way. We do recover. Thank you so much. When I asked a couple of months ago, I think for you guys to write reviews, several of you did. And I really, really, really appreciate it. Oh, I posted on Instagram about it and I really appreciate it. Also, Skylar and I are raising money for one of the houses at my rehab, Choices, for Christmas gifts. And I've been able to help another rehab that I went to a few times because they're more organized and like they kind of do things by the book and they have people that like do things for them because they're under the umbrella of like the mental health services system in California. And so they're way more organized and they are constantly like reaching out to community resources and connections and raising money. And I've done that before. And Choices just like doesn't really do that. They're not really in that space as much. They're definitely kind of a paint by numbers operation. I don't really know how to call it, or I don't really know what you would call it, but you know, they're just kind of like piecing it together and doing the best that they can. And choice has changed my life. I'm so much of who I am, the funnier parts of me and the survivor parts of me, and the fact that I can get so grateful about everything that happened. Like, choices is a huge part of my story. And going there is when I first began to really believe that being a person in recovery could be great and not the worst thing that ever happened to me, because like everybody that was there was so funny. And the owner, like Steve, he played the guitar and he was so funny, and the counselors were hilarious. That's where I met Rachel, and it was just great. When you're there, you typically have absolutely nothing, right? It's a off the street place for the most part, you know, or you go there straight from jail, or, you know, it's typically people don't have much, if anything. And so we've got four guys that we're getting gifts for, that we're getting stockings for. And I would love to raise some money and to get them some really nice stuff. So obviously Skylar and I are getting things, and I am going to put out my Venmo for people to send me money to get them stuff. And I've actually never done any sort of like fundraising through the podcast or through my social media or anything. This is like totally different for me, but it's really worth it to me. Like, I want to get them some nice stuff. And if we just did it by ourselves, like, it wouldn't be as good, right? You know, I'm like, if we could actually get them, like, because they need hygienes, of course, and socks and t-shirts and like the basics, but they also have to start like looking for a job and they don't have anything. I'd like to be able to do some gift cards to like the drugstore right there so that they can get what they want when they go in, because you go on a little store run, but you don't have any money and it's like a fucking bummer, you know, stuff like that. So anyways, when you guys are hearing this, I'll have about a week still. And so I would love for you, in the show notes, I'm going to have a link to my Venmo. And of course, everything I get, all the receipts, I've seen Nate do this. He posts everything he gets. Like, he shows the money and then he shows what he spends it on, because he's, you know, publicly asking for funds and help and donations. So I'll do the same thing. And yeah, so we, the Nod Pod, can give gifts to these guys. And it's going to be from the Chasing Heroin podcast. It's going to be from the Nod Pod community, not me personally. So anyways, any help with that would be super appreciated. You know, even $5, $10, you know, that would be great. My goal is to get 400 total and be able to spend 100 on each. So I'm going to like make a stocking and then, you know, like more than the stocking that we're like stuff the stocking and then maybe a couple of extra things. So anyways, if anybody feels so inclined to help with that, I would really appreciate it. So I hope you guys enjoyed the episode today. And as always, feedback when you hear it is so good for me to be able to send the guest and post to help promote the show. It's all a community effort. So anyways, I'll talk to you guys later. See you next week. Sam, welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm like so honored to be here. And like, again, thank you so much for asking me.
Of course.
On here. It's incredible.
I'm so happy to have you here. I think that you've got a very specific testimony for people to hear, and a specific story that is not one that I've actually really had yet. For one thing, you're really young. How old are you?
So I'm 31.
I thought you were like 24.
I get that all the time.
Oh my God. I mean, 31 is still young. Don't get me wrong. I legit thought you were 20 fucking four. And I was like, oh great, here's my young guy.
You know, it's funny when you like, we were like, oh yeah, like I wanted someone really young. I was like, I mean, I hope she knows I'm like 31, but like, I mean, I'll take it, you know?
Oh my God. I literally thought you were like 24 or 25, but regardless, 31 is actually probably still younger than most of my guests. That's probably the same, but the other elements of your story are super unique too. And I more wanted to have you on because of being sent away and, you know, all of the things that you and I've spoke about on the phone. So why don't we start from the beginning? Because you're not from San Diego, right? I know obviously you ended up here, which is how I met you. But where are you from originally?
So originally, I grew up in Randolph, New Jersey. It is the suburbs of New York City. So it's about like 30, 40 minutes outside of New York City. I was adopted. So I was adopted from birth. So I was actually born in Arkansas and then adopted and brought to New Jersey.
Can you imagine if you'd been raised in Arkansas?
You have no idea. No idea. I actually visited the town that I was like born in. And I mean, beautiful, like Arkansas is a beautiful state, but I just could not even imagine what my life would look like if I grew up there. It's just a different
you're
world.
You're like sophisticated and hip. And I, again, not that Arkansas is not sophisticated and hip, but listen, I'm from Georgia. Like, you know, it's not as sophisticated or hip as a suburb from New York. So I think that you probably ended up in the right place. But okay, so anyways, so you were adopted. Did you ever meet your birth parents? I know I'm jumping ahead, but did you ever meet them?
So I have not. So I was adopted. It was a closed adoption. So I don't really not allowed to reach out to the biological mom. I have like adoption papers. So I know like her name, you know, I know that she was like Cherokee. I know, you know, where she was, her like occupation. So very little, I know very little about her.
Have you ever looked her up on Facebook or anything?
Oh, I have done the whole CSI, like looking online, trying to find her. It's really difficult, especially because like it is a closed adoption. And my understanding is that she doesn't want contact. So that's really hard to try to find her.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. Maybe she uses a different name on Facebook or.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So, and we'll get to that later. But okay. So you were born in Arkansas originally, but you get adopted at birth and you end up in New Jersey.
Correct.
Okay. And what do your adoptive parents do? What's their story?
My mother, who is no longer with us, she was an occupational therapist for a very long time. Both of my parents were Jewish or are Jewish. So yeah, she was an occupational therapist. She worked for like Nordstrom or Macy's for a really long time as like a designer. She would like design the clothing for different seasons of stuff when they were coming out. And then my father is a bankruptcy lawyer. He's been practicing law for about 40 years now,
I think. Oh, shit.
Yeah, okay. He's been doing it for hell a long time.
Wow. Okay. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Do you know why I'm assuming you know why they chose to adopt. They want kids and couldn't have them, or what's the story there?
So I know that my mom was not able to have kids. And, you know, later down the road for me, it made a little more sense because she ended up getting ovarian cancer. So I don't know if that like played into why she wasn't able to have kids. But yeah, she was unable to. So she adopted me. She also adopted my younger sister. She's 6 years younger than myself. Different families.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So what did growing up look like for you?
It was interesting. So I grew up, like I said, like in the suburbs of New York City in Jersey. I was, you know, a little theater kid. Theater was like always my thing. Loved it. Would go to like the theater summer camps and put on all the shows and kind of found my little tribe of people in that. I came out at a really young age. I came out when I was about like 12 or 13. That was hard to navigate at that age. There wasn't a question about it. Like I knew that that's just who I was. There wasn't ever a question in my mind about it. It was never on the fence. It just was like, yes, I'm gay. And I got bullied pretty relentlessly, like through middle school. I only spent like a few months of my freshman year in high school, but got bullied pretty bad through, you know, through the middle school years. And it actually got bad enough that my parents, I started to get like super, super depressed and just like wasn't functioning like, you know, a kid that age group should. So they ended up pulling me out of public school and put me into like a charter school. It was like a very hippy dippy type school, just to kind of remove me from that environment. So at least I could like focus on school and wasn't, you know, walking into, for me, what was like a nightmare every day.
What was their response when you came out to them, your parents?
Oh, I was like doing homework with my mom, like math homework. And, you know, I was like, Mom, I really have to tell you something. I was like, I'm gay. She's like, yeah, like we know, you know, we love you, but like, we know, you know, that you're not shocking anybody. That was, you know, we knew that you were gay and we love you just the same, you know.
Okay. Oh, so they were cool about it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
What did you think the response was going to be? Because, okay, so if you're 31 and you were 12, what was the environment like for being gay at that time? Was it pretty accepted or was it still at an odd time? Because my thought would be that it would be pretty accepted at that time, like culturally speaking. But I guess for like adolescent kids, maybe it's always weird no matter what the cultural environment is. You know what I mean? Is that kind of right? It was culturally accepted, but not by like the asshole kids you went to school with?
Yeah, I think it was definitely, you know, it was culturally accepted, but it was definitely going, you know, there were no gay kids in my school. Like we had 4,100 kids in our middle school and then into high school. So there weren't like a lot of gay kids or people that were openly gay in high school. And so, you know, it was, I mean, there were, I'll say like there were, I had one of my friends growing up, her mother was pretty religious. And like, I wasn't even allowed to go see her or like have play dates or do any of that stuff.
Really?
Yeah. Like she was not about it. I mean, her parents were divorced. So like when she spent time with her dad, I was like able to hang out with her. But yeah, when she was with her mom, I was like not allowed to hang out with her at all.
How did that make you feel? Did you internalize that as there's something wrong with me? Or did you feel like there's something wrong with that lady, the mom?
I think that like subconsciously, I was internalizing that as there's something wrong with me. You know, for me being adopted, it always affected me in a really core level of my being. And so when instances like that would come up, I was like, here's another instance of like someone that just doesn't want me or doesn't want me to be around them. And like, what did I do?
Do you remember the conversation when your parents told you you were adopted? Was that an actual conversation that you remember having?
My mom was the one that had the conversation with me. And she always told me like, listen, I didn't give birth to you. Somebody else did, but I love you and you're still my kid and you're my son. And that's never going to change. There's nothing you can do or say that's going to change that.
Okay. Okay. So when you knew that you're even now at 31, knowing that it was a closed adoption, what are your feelings and thoughts around that? Have you processed that in a way where you're like, now that you're an adult, you're like, I get it. I understand. Maybe you've even known women that either had abortions or, you know, had adoptions that were closed or open. And maybe now you understand that because you know someone that, like, what are your feelings around that now? Like a woman who is faced with a hard decision.
So for a really long time, I held like really deep resentment towards it because I just couldn't wrap my head around it. Like, you know, you hear people that like have their biological parents in their life. They're like, I would do anything for you. You know what I mean? And so I'm left with going like, wow. So like, she didn't want to do anything for me. And so I didn't have an understanding of like that it wasn't me. And that's a hard place for me to get to. I ended up looking through some of my files that my dad had kept when I went to all these like facilities. And I ended up finding out some stuff that hinted towards the fact that she might have been sexually assaulted. And that was, you know, kind of how I came to fruition. And that for me, although so tragic and horrible, it removed the feeling of like it being me. And I was like, I don't blame her. Like I, you know, I couldn't imagine having to make that decision. Totally. And yeah.
Wow. That's super heavy. That's really heavy. Wow. Okay. But I can understand that. Like what you just said, it, obviously that's tragic and horrible, but for me, it helped you get to a place of, because like, I feel like that's all we can really do with our parents. Like there's someone that I know whose mom committed suicide when she was 18 and she jumped off the Coronado Bridge in San Diego and she was 18 and her sister was like 15. And obviously at the time she was like, what the fuck? Like you have kids, you know? And then she learned some stuff about like her mom over the years that when she got older allowed her to like intellectually understand it a little bit more. And I feel like that's what time sort of affords us with, you know, like as with our parents, right? As we get older, but some of those core insecurities stay and stick around, you know? So you go to the charter school and what is the charter school like for you?
Oh, I loved it. It was like this very bohemian hippie school. They were all about like recycling. Like they would take us, there was a like right down the road from it, there was this pond called Speedwell Lake. It's in Morristown, New Jersey. And we would go down there and like pick up trash along the road and like just do stuff like that. The lunch food was like all organic and very health conscious. And like, you know, it was a very accepting and loving environment for me to be in. And so I was like, for the first time, I didn't feel like I was in a hostile environment. And I was like, oh, cool. Like I can just be Sam here. Like I don't have to worry about, you know, putting face on for anybody or worrying about like, you know, when someone's going to yell a slur at me down the hallway or push me into a locker or what have you.
Yeah. So then how do we get from there to you end up getting sent away to a boarding facility? So what is the evolution from happy Sam feels accepted to I'm locked away at boarding school?
So the happy Sam feeling accepted lasted while I was in that school.
Okay.
That was for middle school. And then high school, I had to go back into public school.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, even though I was like happier there because my environment was a lot less hostile, I still was really depressed. And I started to act out a lot more. So like, I think it was like seventh or eighth grade. Like there was a summer where I took like my parents' car out and I used to joyride around just town, like at night, go meet some friends and do stuff like that. And I got pulled over one night.
In middle school?
In middle school.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Got pulled over, you know, cop comes up, is like, you know, driver's license and registration. And I'm like, I have no idea what a registration is. And I'm not supposed to be driving. So they were very nice about the situation. They took me to the police station. My dad picked me up and he was just like fuming pissed off. So there were instances like that where they were like starting to go like, okay, he's acting out. Then like the drinking, like I started to experiment with drinking when I was like about 12. And then when I got into like high school, I didn't know how to navigate going back into an environment that I was so scared to be in because of like getting bullied. And it really like kind of took off when I was in my first few months of my freshman year. And so what I found out was that if I did drugs with the people that were like making fun of me or like anybody, then like, oh, cool. Like they stopped making fun of me. I feel better about myself. And now I have friends. And now I don't have to worry about really being made fun of at all. And if I am being made fun of, like they'll defend me now.
What did you start with? Like smoking weed? And that's interesting too, what you just said. If I do drugs with the people that are making fun of me, they stop making fun of me. What were y'all doing? Weed at the time? Where you start?
So I was like drinking. We were experimenting with like mushrooms, smoking weed, tried ecstasy a few times with them, you know, like cough syrup. Like we were doing like triple C's.
What is that? I don't know what that is.
It's a chloroquine cold cough flu medicine. So it's like Robitripping, I think.
Okay. Is it called purple drink?
Triple C.
Right. But is that also known as purple drink sometimes?
Oh, I'm not entirely sure, to be honest with you.
I know that that's some, I sound so fucking naive right now for someone that used to slam heroin, but I think purple drink is cough syrup.
Yes.
And I think it's the same thing. It's just maybe two different words for it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like two different terms. Okay. So, because that was like not a thing, I don't think. When I was in high school, I don't think people were doing the cough syrup thing. Or if they were, I didn't know about it. Okay. So, You're experimenting with weed, a little bit of ecstasy, some triple C's.
Yeah.
And then what starts to happen?
Well, so those triple C's, they also came in like pill form. That's important because the first time I like took them, I was with this girl and she was like, oh, do you want to do these? I was like, you know, sure. Like I didn't care. I was like, yeah, this is exciting. Let's try something new. And I had no gauge of like, okay, well, how much do you take? So we took like four or five of them and like we waited like 20 minutes and like nothing really was happening. And I was like, okay, so we need to take, obviously you need to take a lot more. So I ended up pounding like 15 more down. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, this ended in like disaster because like it lagged and I just wasn't really feeling anything at the time. And then we're like, all right, well, I guess that's just, you know, it didn't work. So I went back home and like the minute I got back home, it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I just was like absolutely out of my mind. Like I couldn't stand up straight. I couldn't like see straight. My heart was like pounding out of my chest. And I was like actually scared at that point because I was like, oh my God, like this is bad. And I ended up overdosing and had to go to the hospital. And my parents were actually like, I think like the next day or the day after they were supposed to go to Italy and they like canceled their trip and they were like super pissed off about it. Rightfully so, you know.
What is the high from that? What's it supposed to be?
I think it's supposed to be like a body high. I'm not entirely sure because at least that's what I experienced when I was, you know.
Missed the mark your first time.
I took it like up here. I was like, we're going to do this, you know, to the max.
I think it makes you like drunk. The cough syrup.
Yes.
I think it makes you feel drunk is the goal, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. So yeah, my parents at that point were like super like wigged out, like overdose, getting bullied in school, like not functioning as a kid. My grades were just horrible, you know, stealing the car, you know, these crazy things. And then like just getting in fights with them all of the time, you know, and like self-harm. There was just eating disorder. There was like so many things that were just happening all at once. And they just were like, he's young and like just got into high school and this is a lot and we don't know how to deal with it. And so my family one day they were like, hey, you know, listen, you need to get some help. So I tried an IOP program for like a few weeks. It didn't really work out for me because they introduce you to AA. They make you go to meetings and stuff like that. But I was just kind of there to be there because my parents wanted me to be there. And I ended up like using and, you know, I peed dirty. And then they were like, okay, well, now you have to go to like our next highest level of care. And my parents were like, all right, listen, we're just not going to do that. But they did pull me aside one day and said, hey, listen, we found this place. It's in Georgia. It's kind of like a summer camp. You know, you get to go camping and like they'll work on your depression and like some of these behavior problems. So they painted this like really nice picture of where I was going to be going. And like they even have like a website you pull up and it shows like kids camping. And I was like, oh, this is like so exciting. My life here in Jersey is hell. So like I could use a vacation. So yeah, we just packed my bags and we flew to Georgia into the Atlanta airport. And when we got there, they passed me off to like one of the staff members from this wilderness program, Second Nature Blue Ridge. And so they're like, you know, say your goodbyes. And at this point, I didn't think anything was weird. Just, you know, I was like nervous and scared, but this seemed like whatever. Until I get in the car with this guy and he's like in his truck. And he's like, hey, you know, do you want like Wendy's or McDonald's or anything? Because this is going to be your last like real meal for a while. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, so then some red flags were going up. I was like, I thought this was summer camp. Like, what are you talking about? My last meal. And so whatever, we got food. And then we start driving up into like the Blue Ridge Mountains. And we're like on a dirt road. And I mean, it was probably like a good 30, 40 minutes. We were driving into the middle of nowhere. And then they bring you to this little like base camp. And they go, okay, well, here's your like hiking bag. And like, you know, we're going to take your street clothes and we'll give you our uniform. And like, then we'll go bring you to your group. And yeah, they just picked me up and dropped me off in the middle of nowhere with this like group of kids. And just like, that was that. And I was like, where am I? Like, this is crazy, crazy.
So what was it like once you were like in group and stuff? Well, also I have a random question. What meal did you pick for your last meal?
Is it Wendy's? Just like chicken nuggets. Very basic. Just chicken nuggets and some fries with a Diet Coke, you know?
Okay. Just curious.
Yeah.
Okay, so Wendy's. And what was the uniform?
They were like hiking pants and like Under Armour like t-shirt type deal.
Okay. Was it cold? It's fucking cold up there.
Well, so this was in the summertime.
Okay. So like the start of the school year or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. So then what does your day start to look like? Because I know, because I've heard you share in meetings that it was like hell to be there. So what did you guys do? What about it sucked? And how long were you there?
So you were in a group of about like, I don't know, like 9 or 10 guys. They did have a therapist that was offsite, but he would like come and I don't even know how they would find you, but they would like find you in the middle of the woods and they'd do therapy sessions with you. But we would hike like all the time. We probably would stay at like a campsite for like no more than like a day or two. They didn't really want you getting comfortable knowing the environment. But mind you, you like aren't seeing anybody. This is like man versus wild type situation. Like there's no people. You're not allowed to know the cardinal direction. They don't even tell you the time. I mean, obviously, you know, the sun comes up, comes down, you can kind of guess, but you have no idea like where you are. And we'd hike anywhere between like 5 to like the longest one we ever did was like a 13-mile hike in a day. Yeah. And you're carrying like a 50-pound backpack on. You have like, you know, what you got for food was like dried oats that you can mix with like water. They give you like tuna fish packets and like crackers and kind of things like that were like non-perishable.
So was there an adult out there with you leading the hikes and saying, all right, get up, we're leaving, get up, we're on our way?
Yeah. So they had usually about like 2 staff members there like at all times. That would like get you up. Yeah.
Yeah. What was the purpose of this? What's the reason for this?
I mean, if I'm being completely honest, I don't really know. Like, I wish I had a good answer for that because like, I didn't really gain anything from it other than feeling like it was punitive is what it felt like. It didn't really feel like even therapy sessions, like I didn't feel like I was gaining anything from this other than just, you know, this was the consequences for, you know, for what I did.
What do they say it's for?
It's character building. You know, this is how, you know, you be responsible. You get up in the morning. I'm like, I get up in an A-frame tarp tent. Like, I don't see how this is like helping me be a better person, like at all. But I was there for 11 weeks. Yeah. And what ended up happening was I ended up hooking up with a guy there and got in trouble for it.
And
it's a big no-no. They don't like that. That was, you know, they were not interested in dealing with that. So I got in trouble. You know, there's like different levels of like responsibilities and privileges you get. I was like at the top and obviously they were like, yeah, now you're back down to the bottom again. And so in my mind, I was like, okay, cool. I'm running away from here. I've had enough of this. This is like ridiculous, you know, but I'm in the middle of the Blue Ridge Mountains. There's nowhere to run. I ran and I think I may have been gone for like all of but 20 minutes and was like, ooh, yeah, this is not a good idea. I'm going to go back. So I walked back to camp and I was like, all right, yeah, sorry guys. That was my bad. That was not a smart idea.
Did they notice you had left?
Oh yeah. Yeah. They were like, they'd sent a staff out that was like looking for me, but.
Okay. Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. So you go back and then what ends up happening?
So then, you know, obviously now I'm becoming problematic here for them. So my therapist was like, hey, we're going to have a family session with you. And they, you know, I was hoping that I was going home. I was like, cool. Like I've been, you know, been 11 weeks. Like I'm ready. We're good. I can move on. Cause that's what like the deal was with my parents. Like I was just going to this like summer camp and they told me, hey, listen, like you're going to go to another facility. I was like, that's going to be in Utah. And I was like, just up in arms about it. And I was so pissed at my parents. I was like, why? They send me to this other facility that's in outside Salt Lake City in Utah. They had like they use escort services for like, not like sexual escort services. They're like these guys that will come and pick up these clients and like move them elsewhere. I fortunately did not have, I've heard people come in like the middle of the night and wake these people up and like kids to take them to these places. I fortunately didn't have to do that the first time. So I just was moving from one program to another.
Okay. Yeah. I've heard about that too. They come and get crazy. You at like 4 a.m. or whatever. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, they're like, I mean, this dude was like a huge, like there's, it's crazy. Like, I don't know where they're finding these people, but yeah, they brought me to this facility in Utah, like right outside Salt Lake City. And for me, like, unfortunately, this is where like my life got really, really dark really, really quickly. So this facility that was, it was residential. It was like a house. They had two houses, one for the girls, one for the boys. And it was like fenced in with like a huge like gated fence. So we had to stay on the property. We weren't allowed to leave. But they would have like groups. We'd have like groups throughout the day. There was like a main group you would go to that was about like anywhere, like it could really last between like 2, 2.5 hours long. And again, same with like wilderness, you were like put into your like group, which was like 10 guys or whatever. The model of this facility was, we're going to break your character down to absolutely nothing. And if we break your character down to nothing, then we can kind of start rebuilding you into this like better kid. Problem with that is like the tactics they use to do that are like super abusive and just frankly traumatizing, you know? So I like quickly, I was just like, okay, this is not a good situation. And I was like, now I have to go into like survival mode here because this is not cool. You know, they would restrain their clients. And it wasn't just like a, you know, a bear hug. Like we're talking like full blown tackling kids to the floor, putting them in like a chicken hold, using like pain compliance. And that happened fairly regularly. And it was, I mean, you'd imagine like if you saw the way that they'd like restrained these kids, you'd have thought they'd pulled like a knife out or like a weapon and was about to like attack somebody. Meanwhile, the kid told like a staff member to like fuck off, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So that was a scary environment to like be in all the time. Their groups were like the Hunger Games, you know, for like, they basically would like want, you'd have one client in your group that they would just kind of target for that day. And you would just like rip into this dude for like a good 2 hours.
I've heard about that. Thank God I never went to a behavior modification program, but I've heard about those and you just yell at one person. But like, what's wild to me about that is that none of you are therapists. So you're just going through the fucking, going for the jugular for this like person. So, okay. So one person would sit there and you would yell at them.
Yeah. Well, and that's like a good point too, because like, you know, a lot of these kids had like past trauma that were like bringing up in group and like in this like aggressive manner, you know. I mean, it was just like, what is going on here? There's no therapeutic value to this whatsoever. So there's like stuff like that happened. They had the weirdest punitive actions. Like I had one where like I just was like acting out and they made me like sit, like when we'd have our group, we'd sit in a circle, right? They took my chair and like put it in the corner of the room facing like the corner of the wall. And I'd have to sit there. And they like, my group wasn't allowed to acknowledge me as a person. Yeah, it was like crazy stuff. Like, how does that help anything? You know, I had a really scary experience where for me, like this is where I was like, okay, this is, I need to get out of here. There was some trauma that I had talked about with my therapist and he, like we had our groups and sometimes like the kids, their parents would come and visit the facilities and they would sit in on the groups and like, listen, right? So that day I like talked to my therapist about this stuff that was happening and like to me as a kid. And I was not comfortable talking about that in a group environment, which she basically was like, you're going to do. And I was like, I'm 1,000% not doing that. And we got into this like verbal match, and then it became physical again, restraining me. Now they're like bringing me down the stairs to put me in the group room, because they're like, well, you're going to sit here. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. Because whether or not I was going to say something, they would have just aired out my dirty laundry anyways. Like, there was no level of like morale or anything that you could, it just was crazy. So we get down to the group room, right? And now I'm like in a fight with him, and they ended up sedating me and just putting me in my room. And we're still like, all right, whatever. He's crazy. We're just not dealing with that right now. And although I was like acting out at this point because of all these like situations, in my mind, I had gone from, it was very fight or flight. Like, I had turned on, like, now I had to fight to get out of this environment. And the crazy thing was, I'd like call my parents and tell them like, hey, this place isn't like right. Like, this is not cool. Like, they're borderline abusive here, you know? And I mean, not even borderline abusive. They were abusive. It was abusive. And the therapist would always usually be listening on the phone calls, or a staff member. And then it would be, oh, well, this is a manipulation tactic that your kids use to get, you know, out of these programs. And I'm all, I don't care where you send me. I just don't want to be here. Like, this isn't okay. So anyways, I didn't want to talk about that in group, right? So I am now, my punitive action for this was that I was, in my sanction was that I wasn't allowed to have like physical food. So they gave me boosts that you'd give like elders that like can't eat a lot of food and need to like have nutrition. So breakfast, lunch, and dinner boost. At this point, like I said, I was in survival mode. So like, I really wasn't like, I was like, fine, this is just another hurdle I have to get over. I can take a punch, whatever. Well, then a few days later, obviously they saw that that wasn't working. One of my only friends I had there, they were like, okay, fine. So you're not going to talk about it. So he's not going to get food now. He's going to have to drink this boost until you decide you want to have this conversation in the group setting.
What? And
yeah. So like, that broke me, because like me, I could deal with this stuff happening to me. That like completely ruined me. And I was like, whatever, fine.
Is this place still open?
They're not open. They actually... Okay. I don't really want to use a name because they're like still in lawsuit.
You don't have to. Okay.
But
they're not currently open.
No. And they had a lot of charges, like serious, serious charges pressed against them. I mean, are currently like in legal, like battle with a bunch of people. Yeah.
Okay. Because that sounds like the one where you punish your friend because of you. That's like actual psychological torture, I think. I think that that's like, I'm going to sound like an idiot, but I think that's like really fucked up. Like, not just fucked up. I think it's really like, I think that would be classified as cruel and unusual punishment or something. Cause now you're bringing this other kid involved and you're affecting their actual food and nutrients. Do they still have, I don't know if you know the answer to this. I need to look into this because remember I was telling you about my last guest that was trafficked into the massage parlor. She escaped one of these places. That's how she got stuck in Hawaii. She was in one of these places and escaped. That one is still open, but I don't know if they've had to modify anything. Do you know if our wilderness camp still open? Do you know if they still, if that's a thing, is that still legal?
So wilderness, I think that they are still open. The problem is the residential treatment centers, the RTCs.
Okay.
There's a lot of them are in Utah. And like, I mean, I think things now, especially with the whole Paris Hilton documentary coming out, that brought a lot of light to it. So there's a lot more awareness about it. And I think that there's a lot more implementing of like oversight, because no one was overseeing these facilities. Like,
that's,
it was like
crazy.
And the staff members were like, worked at the prison, and you're putting them in an environment with at-risk youth and expecting things to be okay. Like, I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Right. Okay. So they say they're not going to feed your friend either. And you said that breaks you.
Yeah, totally. Totally broke me. Because like, he was now pissed at me, right? And like, I just like, it was so hard to see that. And I was like, fine. You know, I just made the decision. I was like, fine, we're going to go to a group and I'm going to talk about this. And what happens? I get ripped into, you know? And again, this was a really traumatic experience that I had to deal with in my life. There's no therapist that's going to moderate this group that is now out of control, you know? And so at this point, I just felt like completely nothing. I just wanted out. At this point, I started to like resent my parents a lot, because I was like, where are you? Like, what is going on? And like, I keep calling you and telling you that things aren't right here and you're leaving me in this environment. Like, what is going on here? And I mean, eventually I had enough of that place and I just like ran away. And I didn't really get very far. It was like in the middle of winter in Utah. And so I was wearing like a little like t-shirt, some sweatpants and socks. And it's like super cold outside. There's probably about like 6 inches of snow on the ground.
Oh my gosh.
So I ended up like passing out. They brought me inside to the house and the EMS came and like they took me to a psych hospital. And so like that was my ticket out of there because I knew like at this point, if I played my cards right, I wouldn't have to go back. And so that was the end of that. Then once I was out of there, I was out of there.
Okay.
But I was expecting my parents to be like, okay, it's time to come home now. And that wasn't the case at all. Like now it was, yeah, okay, well, you're going to sit in the psych hospital and we're going to find another facility for you to go to, which they did. And I got moved from the psych hospital out a little bit farther into the desert in Utah. And I went to a facility that was like a ranch that you worked on. You did like ranch hand work and, you know, you worked with horses and things like that. So I will say this program was not abusive at all. It was actually really helpful, but I was still kind of like trying to come off of what I just experienced there. And now also really trying to like, there's only so much therapy that you can like give to somebody. You know, at this point I've been in facilities for probably about 2 years now. And I'm like, I'm seeing kids come in all of these places, Wilderness, my last place, and now this place. I've seen kids come and go. And I'm like, what? Now I feel abandoned. I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know what else I can do to like prove that I'm well enough to come back home. And it was really hard. And at this point, I was starting to accept it and just having to go, well, this is my life now. I'm going to have to figure out the best way I can just like survive and make this life, you know? So like I said, they did have like equine therapy and horses there. So like I ended up falling in love with all of that, did a lot of horseback riding. They would take us on these like beautiful horseback rides through like the desert. I did fall in love with that place. Towards the end of my stay there, my mom and my therapist brought me in the office and said, hey, we're going to have a little conference call with your mom. So I'm thinking like, okay, like I'm already expecting the worst. I'm like, I know I'm about to leave here. I would like to think I'm coming home, but like, I'm sure I'm going somewhere else. The phone call was different though. The phone call was my mom telling me that she had been diagnosed with cancer. And I was like, I didn't know how to react to it. I just was kind of taken aback from it. And I was like, okay, like, what does that mean? Like moving forward, like, I don't know what this means now. And she was like, well, I'm doing treatments and like, it's going to be okay. Like, you know, I'm fine. You know, I'm not dying. Like everything's okay. But like deep down, I did not feel that way. I was like, this is not a good situation. Like I don't, you know, I didn't feel like this was going to end well. And so I dealt with that. And then eventually my time at that program came up and, you know, my parents, again, phone conference with therapist going, hey, you know, you're not coming home. You know, we really don't want you home. And we're going to send you to a boarding school. It's in upstate New York. So I'm like,
oh my God. Do you know why they weren't bringing you home?
I don't actually. I mean, I was acting out, obviously, at like a lot of these places. Like, I'm not going to pretend like I was this easy child to deal with because I was acting out. I think it was like a little extreme, but I don't really know.
Did you ever ask them later? Like, because your dad is still alive, right? Have you ever asked him or do you not feel like you can ask?
I haven't asked him. And to be honest, all of that chunk of my life, it's something that it's kind of just buried in the past, you know, like it's something that it happened. And like, you know, I don't even know for me if I had a conversation with him, if it would really bring me any level of like closure or it could be more painful to hear why he didn't want me home, you know?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So they move you to another facility in New York. What age are you now?
So now I'm like 17.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. So close to graduating high school.
Yeah. So I have like a year and a half left of high school left, give or take. So real quick, I mean, this place, I was there for about 2 years. You had a lot more freedom. They had like a theater program. So I was able to get back into doing shows and was like starting to like, you know, get back into dance and all of these things. So they also did like AA meetings there, like the staff members would sponsor you. So I was introduced a little bit more and more into the world of 12-step. I just kind of did it to put on face. I wasn't really interested in doing the work, but you know, at this point I learned that like I had to behave one way in order to manage this environment that I was in. So I was like, sure, I'll do it. So I spent my whole time there. And, you know, it came time towards graduation. I graduated in January of 2012. They did like a summer graduation, and then they would do a winter graduation where you would graduate the program and high school as well. So that was starting to come up. I started to apply to colleges. I got accepted into the American Musical and Dramatic Academy, which is in New York City. It's like a theater program, or theater college, pardon me. And in December, right before I was going to graduate, the admissions director pulled me into the office and said, hey, you know, we need to have a talk. And I was like, okay. He was like, listen, you know, your mom is not doing very well, and we are going to send you home for the rest of the time that you're here. You'll come back, you'll graduate and walk the stage and everything. But we just think that it's best that you spend time with your family right now. So I was like, I mean, she had been gradually getting like worse, but I didn't think we were like at this point. And I got back home, and she was, for lack of a better term, like she was in like a coma. She wasn't alert. She was very in like a vegetative state. And so I spent the rest of like December there. And then she ended up passing away on January 2nd, a couple weeks before my graduation from high school and from programs. Yeah. And that like totally set me off too, because like I, for the first time I had hope in my life. I was like, cool, I'm getting out of these programs and like, I'm going to get to be with my family again. Like, awesome. And that happened. And I just was like, I hated the world. I hated everything. I wanted nothing to do with anybody. You know, I very quickly jumped into going to school. I started my school in February. So I was trying to acclimate into like a normal life. I'd spent the past 5 years in very hyper-aggressive therapeutic environment, for lack of a better term, and in a very closed off environment. And so trying to get used to now being out in society and then managing, you know, the loss of my mom and what just happened to me the past 5 years, it was too overwhelming.
Yeah. So you're in New York and you're in New York City.
So now I'm in New York City. Yeah.
Okay. So you've been in locked facilities and now you're in New York City
trying to go to school, trying to get my life together, you know, and trying to stay sober. Like I did want to stay sober at that time. I didn't really care to go back and like drink or do anything.
Did you feel like you were an addict?
No. And that's really interesting you say that, because that like screwed me for a really long time, because I'd hear going to meetings at that age, you hear these like old timers talk, or even really just anybody talk about like all of the things they went through. And I'm like none of these things have happened to me. I can't relate to you on literally any level. Like,
I would argue you weren't a drug addict at that point too. You'd smoked a little weed. You drank the cough syrup.
But reckless,
you
weren't
strung out on meth or heroin or whatever, you know? So like, I don't know that you were an addict yet. But you become an addict, right? Because now you're like legit in recovery. So what happens in New York, and when do you start like hardcore using? Like what happens now?
So immediately, like I maybe last like a few months and I start drinking. Nothing crazy, you know, just that's what we did. Theater kids went out and had our, you know, got drunk, and I quit. I dropped out of school pretty quickly because I just was like, this is not going to work for me. Ended up dropping out. I moved back in with my dad back in New Jersey. Was going to community college, was kind of like, I don't really know what I'm doing, but my dad was like, you have to be going to school. So like, there's no, if you're going to live here, you're going to school. And I was like, okay, whatever. So I started talking to one of my friends that I graduated the New York boarding school from. And she was like, hey, do you want to move? And I was like, why not? This sounds fun. Like, I have nothing going on with my life. I don't really know what I want to do with my life. Like, let's go. Like, where are we going? She's like, well, I have family that live in like Asheville, North Carolina. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, I've never been there. So we went, we visited. It's beautiful. And so we went down, we found a place in Maggie Valley, North Carolina. And we ended up moving there. It was like this little cabin up in the mountains. It was beautiful. So I ended up moving down there. And this is like kind of where like my addiction now is going to start like growing, because I started like drinking like fifths of liquor, like all the time. We had a guy who was a felon who moved in. He was like gun running in North Carolina into Tennessee. And he moved in with us because I knew his girlfriend, and he was like on house arrest in our house. And he was kind of introducing me into like Molly and all of this other stuff. I started to really get introduced to like guys that were like shooting up. I had never experienced that world before. At the time, I did not, but I was now starting to get like desensitized to this environment. And yeah, I ended up spending a few years there.
Were you working?
I was working, I think, at like a grocery store, a Starbucks, at like a grocery store there. Yeah, I ended up moving, my Coke addiction started now as well. I started to get introduced to Coke and I was like, this is awesome. I love this. This is great. Then I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina after a little while, spent some time there. Now at this point, like, I think this is like, you kind of cross a threshold from just like being a reckless person using drugs into like, okay, this is now very problematic. And like that for me, when I moved to Charlotte, that's like when that kind of boundary was crossed for me. I started using Coke like all the time. I just couldn't function anymore. And I was so miserable. And like, I much prefer to be inebriated all the time than have to deal with Sam. I was super insecure all the time. While I was in North Carolina too, I was dating a guy for like 4.5 years. That was like the most toxic relationship. But, you know, I wanted to be in a relationship. And like, it's weird being gay because I feel like it's hard to get into relationships because you have to really actively search for him. I can't just like go to a coffee shop. I mean, I could go to a coffee shop and maybe meet somebody, but like, I don't think it's not as easy as that. And so like, you know, we find people in bars. And that's like really the only place at the time I could go to like meet people in my community. So we dated, it was not good. But towards the end of my stay in North Carolina, I ended up doing too much coke one night and stayed up for quite some time. I think it had been up for like a couple of days and I thought that I was having a heart attack and I had called the cops and I was like, listen, I used a lot of coke. I think I'm dying. I need an ambulance here. So they show up. They're like, you're fine. We'll take you to the hospital just to like check you out. But like, you're fine. But it scared the hell out of my roommate because she knew that I used, but she didn't think it was like that big of a problem. She thought it was like a little here, a little there. But I was really embarrassed when I came back into the apartment. And the only thing I ever knew how to do in my life was just run away. And so I decided that I was going to pack all the stuff I could, put it into my car. And I spent like the night at the hospital. The next day I went back to my apartment. I cleaned everything up that I could, took everything I could, put it in my car, my little Scion TC. And I drove all the way back up to New Jersey and just blocked her number. I didn't talk to her. I just completely ghosted myself from that equation and never went back to North Carolina.
Okay. Okay.
Now I'm in New Jersey again. And life gets real crazy here. I move back in my dad. I start to develop a really bad Adderall addiction. Start to use meth. I'll get introduced to that through some people. I started hanging out a lot in like the gay bars in New York City. Get introduced to like meth, to G, and all of these things. And for me, like my life just crashed and burned very quickly when I moved back to New Jersey. Now I was in full-blown addict mode. I was breathing, sleeping, everything, drugs. Any time of day, let's do it. And I was working at a restaurant and I don't know how I was able to function the way that I was. I was kind of functioning, but I don't know how I kept my job for as long as I did, but I was a server. So I was kind of, it was acceptable sort of to be able to like, you know, go out and do the partying thing. Yeah. And I did that for some time and, you know, just like anything, like that was only sustainable for so long. And I was introduced for the first time to IV use from a guy. And I was, you know, I was super scared at first, but I, at this point, just kind of was like, whatever, like, let's go. And I just remember that first time he was super high and had no business offering to help me shoot up for the first time because he could barely stand up straight. But, you know, that just was going to show like where I was at in my life. Like I wasn't going to actively go and kill myself, but I sure as hell was waiting for the day that it would happen. And, you know, that was just part of my behavior pattern with some of the stuff I was doing. It was like, I don't want to live anymore. I don't really have the guts to like put a gun to my head, but I'm okay with using drugs until they kill me.
Right. Yeah. And just putting yourself at risk, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
So you're in New York, you meet the guy, you start shooting meth.
Yeah. That was like real scary because like I started to experience psychosis now, which was something I had never experienced before in my life. And, you know, I used to separate myself, right, when I was younger and I could hear people talk in meetings about all of the things they did, how their life fell apart, the relationship, the world, everything. And I could never relate to that. And I could never relate to like the having to wake up and seek out a drug and, you know, that feeling of just like wanting to, for me, like I just wanted to die every single day. I just couldn't. I woke up. I prayed to a God that I didn't believe in that I would just not wake up the next day. And like, it was really miserable and scary and lonely too, because, you know, my whole life, I was always afraid of relationships because I was afraid people were going to leave me. And if I could create this like boundary and like wall up around myself and let you get close just enough that I could have a social relationship, but not a committed relationship with you, then like I was cool, because the second I felt like you were gonna like scorn me or burn me or leave me, I could cut it off and be safe. So that left me being completely lonely. And I was living in this like one bedroom apartment in New Jersey, ended up like not paying rent there at all. So I got kicked out, ended up moving in with my coke dealer. And, you know, for me, this is like where my life really, now we were just like nosediving, crashing, burning. Yeah. I mean, so this experience for me that was like really what changed. I knew, I was like, this is bad. Like, this is where, like, I have a problem, and I can't really deny that I have a problem with any of this, because this is crazy. So I'd been up for a few days and went over to a guy's house. We were going to hook up. You know, I brought my meth. I brought a little bit of heroin. I brought some G. I was like, we're going to have a good time. We're going to make a night of it. And I get there and like, we start to use, and like, I swear I could hear people like outside his house, like walking around his like apartment. And so I started listening closer, and then I could hear that they were like cops. And I heard that they were like, I thought that they were talking to my family, like our family friends of mine who became like my family who I was living with at the time. I thought that they were like talking to them, being like, hey, we're going to go in there. We're going to arrest him. Like, this is how we're going to do it. We just want to prepare you for this. Then I thought they were like, I thought I heard them like putting on those like devices on like a door that they would like break down doors with. So I'm starting to wig out and like freak out. And now I'm freaking this dude out, because I'm like, this is not cool. This is bad. Like, this is about to be all the way bad. I was like, I'm flushing all of my stuff. So I flushed all my shit down the toilet. I was like, I'm not going to jail. Yeah. I was like, I'm not going to jail today. I have never been in jail in my life. I can't. So I convinced him. So he also like flushed all of his stuff as well. Now I'm in his living room, just like in meth psychosis, like convinced the cops are outside that I'm going to jail. And he was like, you literally have to leave. Like, you're crazy. Like, you are crazy, and I need you out of my house now. And I was like, I can't. Like, if I walk out there, they're going to arrest me. So after about like an hour of this, I eventually just like walked out of the house. You know, just on my own accord, I was like, fine, I'm going to get arrested one way or another. This is going to happen. And I get out, shocker, there's like no cops out there, but I still hear them. Like, I still hear them like hiding and like being sneaky. And like, this felt like a Narcos bust is what it felt like. And mm-hmm. It was crazy. And so now I'm like, damn, I just have to make it to my car, and then I can go home and I'll be safe. And so I walk over to my car, I get in my car, and then I get in my car and I'm like, oh my God, this is what they want. Because if I get in my car, now they can hit me with a DUI, and now they have something they can get, you know, I don't have drugs on me now, but now I'm doing something illegal. So I was like, okay, whatever. So I get in the car. Now I think they planted little like microphones in the car, and they were like talking to me through that. And they were telling me to like go drive and drive down this neighborhood and drive here. And I'm driving like an erratic person through this like neighborhood in New Jersey, like at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I was so convinced that, you know, they told me that they wanted me to pull over to the side of the road. And I was like, sure, I'm doing that. Whatever you want. I'm not trying to go to jail today. They go, okay, well, this is so-and-so. I'm like the director of the FBI. You're in trouble. Like, we've got you. We know that you've been using drugs, and, you know, we know you have meth on you and all of this crazy stuff. We're going to need you to step out of your car. We're going to need you to go to the back of your vehicle, open your trunk, and we're going to just get into the trunk, and we'll send like agents over to come get you, we'll arrest you, whatever. So I'm so scared. I'm like, okay, yeah, absolutely. Like, sure, whatever. So I do that, and I get into the back of this trunk. I lock myself in there. And now I was just completely out of my mind crazy, because I thought that now they were making fun of me that I was in the trunk. It was just this like insane meth psychosis frenzy that I had been on now for like a couple hours of these cops.
Holy shit. So you pulled yourself over and got in your own trunk?
Yeah, like 1,000%.
Damn. Oh my God.
1,000%. You know? And, you know, meanwhile, they make like these trunks. They have like the little lever thing that you can pull in case you get like, I think it's if you get like kidnapped or if someone were to accidentally lock yourself in a trunk like me. Yeah. Totally. So they have like those buttons on, you know, in the trunk that you can pull, but you know, it's dark. I've been up for days. I'm now in a psychosis. I'm not finding that. So I'm trying to like kick out the headlights in the back. It was bad. So anyways, I ended up passing out in the back of this trunk, because it's like the summertime. It's hot.
Did you have your phone with you, or was it in the car?
No, oh no. My phone was like, car was running. My phone was up in the front of the front seat of the car.
The car was running?
Yeah. Car was running.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I'm gradually getting more hot. I like passed out. I didn't really know how much time had elapsed, but I was able to like, you know, in the back seat, there's like the middle seat and the part of that will kind of come down. I was able to like push that down and like manage my way through there. I look at the clock and it's been like 4 hours. So
Oh my gosh. Whoa.
I wasn't so much at this point mentally, like I was a little more calm. I was still like very much out of it, but I was like, okay, what do I do now? So I ended up calling the cops and I was like, I need help. Like, I need help. Like, this is crazy. And, you know, for me, that was like such a moment. Like, it was so important because like that moment in my life, like I was like out of body experience where I was like, who are you? Like, who are you? Who have you become? Like, you know, luckily I can look back now and like laugh at myself for some of these things. But like, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, what, like, who are you? And like, how did you get to this point, you know, where I'm calling the cops because I locked myself in the trunk of a car, you know? So I ended up going to the psych hospital. They let me, like, I went there for like an evaluation or whatever. And they let me go that night. And that scared the hell out of me because I had the blurring of reality I had never dealt with ever. And that not knowing what was real, what wasn't real. And even days after that, when I had like sobered up a little bit because it scared the hell out of me, I was still hallucinating. And I didn't know what was real anymore. And it was crazy because it's like, that's what I wanted. Like, I didn't want to know. Like, I hated my life so much. I didn't want to live in my reality. Now that I didn't know which was what, I was like terrified. So I last another couple weeks. And then again, I go to another guy's house to hook up again and use meth because I didn't learn from the first time. Yeah, I put myself in a really bad situation that night. And fortunately, you know, was assaulted. And I woke up the next day in this like really dirty, grungy apartment. And it was like the first time in my life, I had the courage to kill myself because at this point I woke up and I was like, I have become a shell of a human. I don't know who I am anymore. I'm like living this crazy life, which I knew was crazy, but I needed it in order to survive. And I just was over it. I was tired. I was beaten down. I was like, I'm throwing in the white flag. Like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I'm exhausted. And so my phone was dead. So I had no way of like Ubering back to my house. And I asked this guy, I was like, hey, do you have any like medication or anything? He's like, why? I was like, no, just like wondering. He's like, I mean, I have Tylenol in like my, in the bathroom. So I was like, sure. So I took a handful of Tylenol, left out the door, popped them all and was like, this is what we're doing. I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to go, you know, there was like a lake and like a little park by his house. So I sat there and yeah, I just popped all of these Tylenol and hoped that like that would be it for me and that I would, you know, finally be done. And the really sad thing was there was a moment in time when I was like, because, you know, I was starting to go out of it a little bit. There was a moment in time where I was like super, I felt like at peace for a moment because it was just this beautiful lake. And I was like, wow, there's like nothing I have to worry about anymore. Like, I don't have to feel this pain anymore. And, thank God. I don't even know how. I mean, I texted while I was sitting there, like some of my family friends, like essentially a goodbye letter. And they called, you know, EMS and they were able to find me at this park. I have no idea how they did. They found me in time and I was brought to, you know, the hospital and now admitted into the hospital. It was awful. I had to like detox in the ER, which was like just like a nightmare. Just a nightmare.
Does a bunch of Tylenol hurt you? I didn't even know that.
So I really didn't know. I was just like, anything that I can take in mass quantity, I was hoping would do some damage to kill me.
Well, I think it does though. Somebody I know did the same thing and they did bring him to the hospital and pump his stomach. So it must.
They'll do that. Okay. It also, I know, can affect your liver.
Right. Yeah.
Even if you don't kill you, like it can create like some serious liver damage, which was the concern when I went to the hospital. They did like tests. They were like, we need to make sure that you didn't like completely just destroy your liver. But yeah, I just, at this point now, I'm in like the psych hospital. I forgot to mention, my dad for the past like year and a half was not talking to me. He had like wrote me an email and was like, you are out of control. We don't want to talk to you anymore. Don't talk to the family. You know, like we're done with you. Like this is, you know, you've burned this bridge and we're done. So
did you have any relationship with the younger sister?
You know, not really. Unfortunately, like just because I was away for so long.
Yeah.
And I never really cultivated that relationship with her.
And you were older. Six years is a big difference between genders. And then you leave and, you know, so.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're alone. You're alone and you're in the
hospital. Alone. Yeah. Alone. And I will say at the time, like I said, I'd been living with some family friends who she was close with my mom. So this family, like I love dearly, they took me in and I owe a lot of my getting into recovery. I owe all of that to them because she talked to my dad. She was like, hey, listen, your son is going to die. I hope you know that. Like, and I'm not trying to make you feel bad about it. This is just like, matter of factly, he's going to kill himself. Okay. And so she was able to like convince him to talk to me. And while I was at the psych hospital, he was like, listen, like we can, you know, I'm willing to help you. If you're willing to go to rehab, like I'm totally here for this. And like, I will help pay for it. I'll make sure you get the help that you need. And at this point, like I had nothing, like I didn't have a job to show for. I don't really have that many friends at this point. I don't have money to my name because I was like moving around all the time and like getting evicted from places. I lost all of my material things. So I like really didn't have much. So, you know, I was in a psych hospital and was like, yeah, I need help. So my dad helped me find a facility in New Mexico. They dealt with trauma because I knew that I needed to deal with everything that had happened in my life. I knew that it was important that I start to address these things and figure out how to maneuver through it. Otherwise, I was going to continue to live under the shadow of all of this stuff my entire life. And we found this like trauma facility that's in New Mexico and went there. They do like EMDR therapy. They had like a very holistic and natural approach to like trauma responses and things like that. So, and I was able to finally work on some of this stuff. Although like my dad was like, I really want you to go to like a drug rehab facility. I was really hesitant because I was like, I don't really want to do the whole, because I knew that if I went to one, I was going to have to do 12 step. I knew that that was right. What was going to follow was right. You have to get into recovery. And I was like, I don't really want to do any of that. Like, I'm not interested in that. I don't think that's going to help me. My problem is that all of this stuff happened to me in my life. You know, not that I have a drug problem, but I agreed. I was like, you know what? I did a lot of like inner child work and like a lot of really good work at this place and was able to get to a point where I was like, okay, I do have a drug problem. Like, yeah, these things happen to me, but like, you know, I just went on like a 10-year bender. Like this is problematic. You know, wake up, smell the coffee.
But that's some good ass therapy, dude. If you showed up, like, I don't have a drug problem. I've got some trauma. And then you were like, but the result of my trauma therapy was that like, I'm a drug addict. They did their job, obviously. So wait, how old are you when you get to this facility in New Mexico?
So this is like fairly recently. This was like a year and a half ago. Yeah.
Okay. So I was probably like, okay. So now we're getting into when I met you. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what therapy do you think worked the best for you? I think EMDR is incredibly helpful for trauma. I've done a little bit of EMDR. My husband, who's experienced ridiculous amounts of trauma in his life, has done EMDR, which has helped him a lot. What would you say was like one of the most beneficial forms of therapy that you got while you were there?
Definitely EMDR. At first, you know, EMDR, they have the light strip and it just kind of like goes back and forth. And I don't really know the science behind it, but it's supposed to help unlock parts of your brain that you're like, or your mind that like will shut down due to trauma.
Right. Okay.
That at first I was like, this seems crazy. Like it's just a light bar that I'm looking at. And, you know, this therapist is like prompting questions to me. But over like the course of a few weeks, like it really, I ended up things that I had forgotten about in my childhood and things I had forgotten about, even like when I went away to like treatment as a kid, like started to like come back to me. And it was very, very overwhelming. It was very overwhelming, but very, very helpful. So that, and then also like inner child work, you know, there was like this part of me that I was dealing with, like being abandoned my whole life. And then this feeling of being abandoned and that nobody was there to protect me in any of these situations, you know? And for the first time in my life, as a full grown adult, I was going to have the opportunity to show up for myself and show up for my younger self. And that was like so powerful for me because I was like, oh my God, because my whole life, I was always waiting for like somebody to come save me from my life and the destruction that was happening, or like an event to happen that was going to like catapult me into something better. Or like when I finally came to understand that like nobody was coming to save me and nothing was going to save me at this point, that this was going to be up to me to do. Like that changed like everything, my trajectory of like where I was going and how I was going to approach everything that I just went through, like changed entirely.
Wow. That's really powerful. What you just said, what does inner child work look like?
So a lot of that was, you know, talking to like, it would be like talking to younger Sam, right?
Okay.
Being like, you know, particularly with like, I'll use the example of when I was getting like physically abused at that facility, it would be like talking to Sam, you know, being like, it's okay, I'm here for you, you're safe. So it was a lot of work that was just like you speaking to the younger you. And then they had like a therapist there, you know, you were getting prompted through a lot of it, but yeah.
And so at some point in this process, you start to think, okay, also, I think I have some addiction stuff happening.
Oh, 1,000%. Like, I think that I'm, you know, I always knew that I was an addict. Like, I don't want to like make that seem like I was like in La La Land. Like, I would like literally be high and looking up on YouTube, like, how do I stop using meth and heroin? And look up videos. Like, what?
Me too. I would look up meetings, not so much on heroin, but on coke. I went through this period of, I watched the Tina Turner movie, What's Love Got to Do with It? And she is Buddhist. And the Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, the meditation that she says, which I actually couldn't remember just a few weeks ago when I interviewed a Buddhist guy, but somebody commented on my YouTube video. And I'm like, that's right. I would be blasted on cocaine in my bed, meditating, trying to become somebody that like never did cocaine again, like wall high. But I know what you mean. I knew I had a problem, but like not really. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, no, the coke is certainly problematic, but I'm not like a 12-step addict alcoholic in a church basement person. Like that's what I thought.
Yeah. I think for me, it was more or less, I felt justified in my use. Like I felt like the world was like, super cruel. And like all these things happen to me. And so like, yeah, this is my golden ticket. This is my pass to be able to do whatever I want to do. And if I want to get high, I want to get high and I'm going to do that. So, yeah.
So you did heroin too? I don't think I knew that. Were you?
Very, 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 like it was very towards like the end of my drug use. Thank God I didn't really get into it. But
so you never got strung out and had to kick and do the whole bullshit?
Not really. Okay. It was like, I would be up because of my meth use. I would be up for so long that like, even I wanted to go to sleep. I was like, I need to be able to take a little time and a little break to like mentally shut down. Because I knew you could go into psychosis again. So nothing was working to like, put me out. So
if there was ever a responsible way to do heroin, that's it. Just a little bit at a time after just multiple days of meth use. Yeah. And then you don't actually get strung out. That was my plan every time. Just a little heroin to take the edge off the meth. And then I'm strung out on heroin. But okay. So you start thinking, sure, I think I also have some addiction problems. And then did you start saying I'm open to 12 step again? Or how do you get to San Diego and get to a 12-step meeting where I met you?
So I was very, very, very cautious about getting into 12-step because I was like, I knew what the environment was like. Also, like, I didn't trust the process there. Like, I thought that all of these people, I clumped everyone in my past together. And so everyone that was like in recovery or like in my therapy background, like they were all the same to me. And I was like, I don't trust any of you guys. You know, I started to like be a little bit more open to the idea of, okay, well, what other options do I have? You know, and so I finished that program up in New Mexico and I ended up finding, I was like, I know I need a rehab. Like, I know I do, you know? And it was hard because like getting into committing for that long brought up all of the memories from the past of like, oh my God, like minute, I mean, at 31 or 30 at the time, I was like, I have free will to leave. But all of that stuff was coming back up. And I was like, oh my God, I don't trust none of this. This is bad. This ended really bad last time. I got Shanghai'd for like 5 years. Like, this is not going to end well. But I said, you know what? This is the only thing I have. Because what do I have right now? I have literally nothing. And I'm tired of just not wanting to be alive anymore and to having to like destroy people's lives around me in order to get like some mental relief from everything. So we find a program went to Immersive Recovery, which is in Encinitas, but similar to like that one program you're saying, it's like they had homes and then you would like drive to the center. So they had homes in like San Marcos and like Vista, Escondido. But yeah, I went there and that's like where I now am in like rehab. So now we're doing like 12 step. This is where everything gets introduced. And I'm like, oh God, don't want to do this. But again, I don't know what was in me. I think we talk about like, you know, the gift of desperation in the rooms. And I think at this point, that's kind of like that desperation I had way outweighed me being uncomfortable about going into 12 step. I was like this, I need help. Yeah. I started to, you know, the program that I went to, you know, they took us to meetings and then I went to one, like a CA meeting actually. And I heard this guy talk and I was like, oh my God, he's amazing. And like, I could tell he was gay. And I was like, oh my God, like I need this guy to be my sponsor. So after the meeting, I went up, I said, hey, I love you. This, like your share, I like touched me. Like I related to all of it. And like, would you sponsor me? I mean, he was like, you know, like, yeah, make some phone calls first. We'll talk first. And I, you know, immediately my insecurities came up and I'm like, oh, he doesn't want me. He's a sponsee. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. So I did. I called him and I kept calling him. So then, you know, we ended up started doing step work together and met him. And, you know, he's been such a blessing in my life. Introduced me to
he's still your sponsor. That's your sponsor.
Still my sponsor.
Was that the Harding Street CA meeting, that huge one?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, cool. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And he's still your sponsor?
Still my sponsor today.
Okay. Yeah. So what was the experience of having a sponsor that you trusted, also gay, work you through the steps? Because, and I know I heard you share about this at a meeting once, it was hard for you to wrap your head around the higher power thing because, you know, in certain aspects of religion, not spirituality, but religion, the messaging is you're not supposed to be you, right? And so then how do you come to terms with that? So was he able to help you find a higher power that you could, I do not want to say do business with because I will not be that person. I won't. It almost came out of my mouth. Could you tell?
Yeah.
No, the higher power that you could work with and be comfortable with.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. You know, that was hard for me because I came into the rooms and like, girl, every word in the 12 step, there was God. And I'm like, yeah, like you're funny. Like your God wants me dead, tells me I'm going to hell. How do I navigate that? And granted, that wasn't even my God. Like I grew up in a Jewish household. Like,
right, yeah.
You know, this is just like what I viewed God to be. It was this just, you know, damning thing. And I was not normal and whatever. So working with my sponsor, who was also gay, it was very important for me because he understood that part of my life and understood that this was going to be a hurdle. And he said, listen, this is not something you're going to figure out right away. Like, he's like, my sponsor is 20 years. And he was like, I still am on my journey with my higher power. Like, you know, he's like, we're not just going to like find one for you and it's going to be like this wonderful relationship and you're going to like understand it all, you know, which is what I kind of was expecting. The God of your understanding, I just don't particularly like using the word God, but like, you know, it was a higher power of my understanding. And so at first I like didn't even know to where to begin because like, where do you look for a higher power, you know? So I started to like listen to people in meetings talk a lot. Pardon me. I listened to people in meeting talk about their higher power and, you know, was like, okay. Some of that I was like on board for. I was like, that makes sense. And then a lot of it was like, I went, my sponsee brother who I met, who I also love very dearly and has been, you know, just a huge support in my recovery, introduced me to this place called Deer Park Monastery. It's in Escondido. It's this like Buddhist monastery. And they open it to the public, I believe on like Sundays, and they'll do like services and like Dharma talks. So he took me to this place and like the first one that we went to, they brought in a monk from Vietnam and they had like a translator and she started her Dharma talk and she starts talking about addiction and suffering. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, I hear you. Like, I'm here, you know.
Okay.
And at that moment, yeah, I felt like I was where I was supposed to be. And, you know, for me, you know, I started to feel a little more comfortable with the idea of a higher power. Still didn't know what that looked like, but you know, all I knew to do was to just, you know, for me, I meditated, you know, I would like talk to my higher power, like I would my sponsor. I just was like, hey girl, like, you know, this is what happened today. You know, like I want to do your will, you know, like I'm struggling with X, Y, Z, like allow me to be patient today. Allow me to like overcome obstacles. You know, they're going to, you know, be presented to me today. And it felt awkward at first. Cause at first I was like, I don't want to say I felt stupid. I just didn't feel like this was going to work. I was like, this seems very weird. And I don't really feel like this is a thing, but I had faith that it would eventually work out. So yeah, like, I mean, that's how, you know, I still to this day, like I struggle with it, you know, it's not perfect, but like, as long as I'm actively doing something to better that relationship or better my understanding or my practice of having a relationship with my higher power, like, that's all I can do, you know, and it doesn't have to be perfect, right? And that's what I strive for because I'm a perfectionist. I want to know exactly what my higher power looks like. I want to know what my higher power's, you know, belief system is and all of these things. And it's like, it doesn't need to be that. Like I complicate the living hell out of it. It's just not, you know.
Well, and I think what's important too is, did you do all 12 steps or where are you with your steps?
So I did 12 steps with, when I first came out here with the sponsor, we did them really quick. And then, so right now I actually just finished a fifth step and I'm going on to my sixth step with my new sponsor.
Okay. So you were able to do the steps with an evolving idea of a higher power. I think that's important for people to know.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, so for me, like I do the steps out of the NA workbook, which is like, it is marathon step work.
It's extensive. Yeah.
Very, but you know, a lot of the questions I appreciate because they prompt things like this in the first step. And even going into second step, they prompt a lot of these ideas about your higher power. And so I think for me, that was like really helpful, you know?
Oh, your new sponsor, the guy that you have right now, the one that you saw at the meeting.
Yes.
So somebody else got you through the steps initially. Good.
Yeah.
And then you found this guy. Got it. Okay. Okay. So he's still, but the one that you were talking about is still your current sponsor.
Yes, yes, yes.
And then there was one other thing that I wanted you to share because this really struck me in your lead at the meeting that I heard you lead in. You almost relapsed and the community of the group stopped you. Can you share that story?
Yeah. Well, so I did relapse.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, at the time I had about 10 months and I was, you know, I was doing everything that I was like told to do, like in the meetings, which was get a sponsor, go to meetings, pick up commitments, talk to people, go to like events and stuff like that. And I was like, ugh, I don't get this, but sure. Because I was told to do it, I was going to do it. But I ended up relapsing and drinking. I went away to Oregon and I came back. And at the time I was working for the rehab facility that I went to. And so on my flight home, you know, thank God I didn't pick up a narcotic, right? But my mind, my addict mind, like it kicked in. It went into overdrive. I was like all over the place, you know, Pandora's box was open. And all of these like thoughts and about like, well, how well now I need to use because now I just wasted a relapse on drinking. I didn't even get the good stuff, you know? And then I was like starting to plan how I was going to like be homeless, how I was going to be able to like use meth, you know, what I was going to do. And like, I was going to move to LA and I was like, oh, this crazy stuff that just like kept spiraling in my head. And on the flight home, all I could think about, there's like a little section in the NA thing that was like alcohol is a drug, period. And I was like, okay. Like true. Cause I was like, I didn't relapse. Did I really relapse? And it was like, yes, 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 you did. And now your brain is going into crazy mode. And I got back, I told the director of my program, like, hey, listen, I need to be transparent. I relapsed. And he's like, well, do you intend on staying sober? And I was like, absolutely. Which at the time, yeah, I meant that then. But like, I was really on the fence about like, I was like, I just need to go back to the sober living so that I can like figure out what my next move is going to be. And, you know, I'm sitting there and I get back to the sober living and they were like, hey, we're going to put you on a 2-week leave. And I just, my world started to feel like it was falling down. And, you know, again, so what does Sam do when his world falls apart and I ruin everything? I'm going to figure out a way to run. And, you know, it was a fork in the road for me because I was like, I have done this my entire life and I have, and I've been left with nobody. And the first time in my entire life, I have people that I care about and that I actually genuinely love. And like, they know stuff about me and like, I love spending time with them, you know, like, I don't want to give that up. I don't want to just up and leave and never see these people again. You know, I'm also sitting there going like, as I'm trying to plan out how I'm going to be homeless and use drugs and be like an active addict again somewhere, I'm like, oh my God. So at the time I had a literature commitment for NA and I have like all of these books in my car and I'm like, well, what the fuck am I supposed to do with these? Like, I'm not like, what I'm going to like run away to LA, become a drug, like active addict again. And like have all of these like NA literature in the back of my car. I was like, I mean, you know, I've done some bad stuff, but like, I'm a good person. Like, at least I'm going to return these. But I was like, oh, but then I'm going to have to see them. And like, you know, I was like, it was crazy. So I was like, well, I'll just like put a little note on it. I'll drop it off at my sponsee's brother's house. He'll take care of it. Bada bing, bada boom. And then I'm like, oh, my sponsee brother. I was like, oh, Jesse, I don't want to leave Jesse. You know, like, you know, he introduced me to the gay community and recovery in here in San Diego. And it was like, I met all these wonderful people, you know. I could not fathom walking away from all of this. And I had met like people in NA. I found a group of people in HA who are like the most beautiful people I have like literally ever met in my life. And I just, you know, I couldn't. And so the thing that comes to mind through all of that, like I did not go back out, and I'm coming up now on 6 months next week.
Yay.
You know,
are you going to take a token at the Saturday meeting? Are you going to take your 6 months? Will you be there?
I'll take it next Saturday. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Okay.
Yeah. So, but what comes to mind is like, you know, I'd always, and this ties back to higher power, right? I'd always heard people in the rooms be like, oh, if you know what your higher power is, use like a doorknob or like, you know, this or that, or like use the group. And that never made sense to me because I was like, I don't understand how you collectively as a whole are going to do anything for me if I'm in a crisis moment where like I'm in front of a drug and I'm about to use. Like, how is that going to work? Until this happened. And I sat there and I was like, this love that I had for these people that I met, I wasn't willing to give up and was way more powerful than my addict mind. So in that moment, the people in the room, whether it was my higher power or my higher power acting through them, they kept me from going out. And so like, you know, in meetings I share all the time, like you guys saved my ass. Like I genuinely mean like you guys saved my ass. Like I could not be sitting here having this conversation right now, you know?
So the group actually was your higher power, which You're right, they say, but it's like, what does that actually mean? But like you just described what it means, or at least a way that it could be used. Like you didn't want to let these people down and leave them. That's like the coolest use of that I've ever heard. So last thing, then we'll wrap up because I'm talking your ear off. I knew this was going to be a long one. I knew it. That's why I was like, do you have a hard end time? You don't, right? Because no. I know you got a lot of stuff cooking. So what does your life look like now? What do you do now?
I am happy with my life right now. You know, like I have my own, you know, place that I share with three other roommates of mine, you know, all in recovery, right? I do have a job, you know, I have a car finally, you know, when in my addiction, I got my car repoed, you know, and had to walk everywhere. Now I have a car, I can drive places, you know, I have a community of people that show up for me and I show up for them, you know, and all of my life, that's all I ever wanted. You know, being adopted and trying to find my place, or, you know, being gay and growing up and trying to navigate the struggles of that and fitting and finding like where I fit into all of this, you know, like I have that today. And, you know, I think sometimes when I hear people talk and they're like, you know, I'm living a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I'm like, I have no idea what the fuck you're talking about because I am living a very mediocre life right now. And for me, that's like a blessing. Like, yeah. I have a home. Like, I used to have to like couch hop and like find where I was going to sleep next. Like, this is fine for me right now. And, you know, I'm so grateful for where I'm at today. I don't wake up every day feeling like I want to off myself, you know? That's not to say that like I don't struggle, because by, you know, I absolutely do. And I have days where I find it hard to find like the motivation and that spark that like ignites in me that like, yes, I want to live my life of recovery and like do all of these things, you know, but that's what the people in the rooms are for. You know, when I'm feeling like that, I share about it, or I talk to people, or I'm of service to somebody else. And I'm like, completely forget why I was even in some, you know, funky mood to begin with. I used to hate when people would say that. They'd be like, oh, I'm so grateful for where my life is today. You know, it's like so great, but like it is, you know. You know, lastly, like I always had the expectation that like when I started doing step work and getting into the rooms, that it was going to like, my life was going to be this great, beautiful thing all of a sudden, you know, and the steps do not make my life better. What the steps and recovery did for me was gave me an outlet for me to be able to cope with my life and function as a human being, because I didn't know how to do that. I was not functioning as a human being for many, many years, you know. And I have the means to be able to cope with my life, you know, and through that, life gets better because I'm able to have meaningful relationships. I can show up to jobs, you know, I get to go on adventures and do all these fun things. And so like, you know, that is a result of doing that stuff.
That's like the best pitch for the steps I've ever heard. Like, is it going to change your life? Maybe not. But does it allow you to cope with your life? And then because you manage your life better, your life, of course, evolves because of all of the things that you just said. That's such a beautiful way to put that. This was amazing.
Thank you.
You did so good. He was nervous at the beginning, you guys, but you did amazing. You are such a good speaker. You are such a great storyteller, and you are honest and authentic. And like, this is going to go down as one of my favorite shows I've ever done. I cannot tell you how impressed I am by you and your speaking ability and like the story that you have to share is so unbelievably like unique and helpful. And I'm so happy that like, that you made it and that you're here. What is the relationship like with your dad now?
I talk to my dad. Actually pretty regularly, and not to ask him for money, you know, just to be like, right. You know, hey girl, how are you doing? yeah, I have a relationship with him today, you know, and it's unbelievable.
He must be proud of you. I mean, he has to be just blown away that you're even okay.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think there's still definitely stuff that happened throughout the years that we just kind of don't talk about. I don't know if we ever will. I don't know if that will ever be part of our relationship, you know, but for today, like, you know, we have a relationship again, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So do you have, if anybody is interested in like reaching out to you or thanking you for this episode, which I'm sure they will, are you open to sharing your Instagram or what's your
Instagram?
I don't even have it. I don't even follow you.
So it's Sam Aaron Marks, all one word. So it's SamAaronMarks.
Oh, I do follow you. I follow you. Okay. Awesome. So if anybody else wants to connect with you, now they can as well. Oh, I cannot thank you enough for doing this. Oh, no, I lied. One last question. What's your favorite step if you have one and why?
Ooh, okay. You know, this is like so crazy. For me, my favorite step is the fifth step. I think the fifth step is like so powerful, and I think it's so misunderstood doing fourth and fifth. You know, there's this like intimidation by doing it. Like, oh my God, I'm going to talk about how big of a piece of shit I was and like all of these things in my life. Like, I lived with all of that stuff for however many years. Like, I know what that is. I'm just now sharing it with somebody. And the being able to like go, this is what I did, and have somebody else go, you know, that you have this like cycle of doing this thing and going like, oh, holy shit. Like, I do. And like having that insight for me, I think was the most powerful part of doing, you know, the steps. So that doing a fifth step with somebody was like my favorite by far.
That's a good one. Yeah, that's so true. Like the patterns. I love that. Okay. Well, I have to answer all these fucking phone calls, and I know you have a day to go about and do.
Yeah.
Sam, thank you so much.
Seriously, thank you so much. This was incredible. And like I said, I'm so honored that you even asked me to do this. The first time I heard you speak, I just was so blown away. And just like, you know, there's people in the rooms that you just, I don't like using the word like look up to, but like I look to hear what you have to say, because you're just, you're so powerful in what you say and like what you do with the podcast and everything. It's just like beyond anything. It's really beautiful. So thank you. And thank you for asking me to be on here. Like I said, it was an honor.